You're listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with globally recognized AI advisor Henry Eider. This podcast is supported by the Yamashaski Foundation.
I feel potentially something I'm concerned about, and I guess by extension I would like to preserve, is a real sense of empathy and humility, which comes with understanding that the world is messy, that people are messy, that defects and imperfections exist, that things don't always necessarily go the way you want, even as much as you wish they could. Imperfection is part of life. My concern is that AI-generated content, which smooths and perfects a version of reality to precisely what you want and makes you feel pressured to represent yourself in this absolutely perfect way, fundamentally gives you no room for error and detaches you from the reality of growth and life and how people work. Things don't always have to be exactly perfect to how you want them to be or how other people want them to be. And that involves having some humility about yourself as a messy creature, as we all are, right? I hope that's retained. I'm sure it will in some senses, but I do see this sort of smoothed and shaped reality that AI is enabling as potentially creating more of a disconnect between that kind of imperfect, messy, but also quite beautiful world and this polished, but ultimately plastic version of reality that increasingly is becoming the default for some people over the fleshy, messy human side of things. Having worked in this space for 7 years since the inception of deepfakes in late 2017, for some time, it was possible with just a few hours a day to really be on top of the key technical developments, use cases, malicious and positive. Now, particularly since the explosion of generative AI, ChatGPT, DALL-E 2, all of these kinds of tools that emerged in 2022, I don't really think anyone can say that they are on top of everything because there are so many people developing, so many businesses being built, so many use cases around the world. The disinformation and use of deepfakes in the political sphere to deceive, to try and persuade, has become a lot more established and really matches some of the fears held 5-6 years ago, but at the time were more speculative than they were instantiated in what was actually happening. I've always really said, well, look, we've got some fairly narrow examples of deepfakes and AI-generated content being deployed, but it's nowhere near on the scale or the effectiveness required to actually have that kind of massive impact. This year, it's no longer a question of, are deepfakes going to be used? It's now, are they actually going to have the impact that people fear they will? We really are starting to see a maturation of AI-generated content in these kinds of attack vectors or threat vectors. Is this actually changing voters' minds? Is this actually going to have a concrete result on the outcomes of elections or the perceptions of a government about a politician? The jury is still out on this at the moment. There's a lot of correlation, causation challenges there. But I think it's fairly safe to say that both state actors and malicious domestic actors are starting to become aware of how these tools can be used maliciously. I think a lot of the discourse around generative AI is very much you're either kind of an AI zoomer or you're an AI doomer. You're either really excited and you want to accelerate development, or you're terrified and you're making comparisons of this as a threat like the nuclear threat and should be treated as really dangerous. For me, I don't think we need to have this mutually exclusive attitude. I think we can look at different use cases and say, well, look, this is really exciting in healthcare, in accessibility, in art. But those very same baseline technologies can be weaponized. And if they're not developed responsibly with the appropriate safety measures, the appropriate guardrails, the appropriate understanding from people using and developing them, we could end up seeing quite a few malicious outcomes. So it is really about that balancing act for me. There's a lot of nuance, but I can understand why for certain groups, let's say, if you're a woman and you've been targeted by deepfake non-consensual pornography and you know that hundreds of thousands of other women are being targeted, you may be thinking, well, this is a much bigger threat than the potential benefits of this technology. So we need to do that kind of assessment. By the same token, I can see why other people in other sectors are thinking, well, look, the benefits far outweigh the potential risks. But I think the general attitude is we need to get this right. We saw what happened with social media, where we didn't understand the implications and the ramifications until it was too late. We have a chance to do it this time. Detection tools can be really useful, but there's a big caveat there, which is they're useful when used by people who understand their limitations and have the ability to look for more signals than just that detection. You're never going to have a 100% accurate model. There is no one detection system to rule them all, so to speak, right? You'll never be able to give you a binary yes or no answer. it will be able to give you a percentage confidence score based on probabilistic reasoning, 80% confident that it's real, so on and so on. So we've actually seen in the hands of everyday people this actually doing more harm than good, because they've sort of trusted blindly a detection system which is not robust. Like as we are seeing in the current crisis in Israel and in Gaza, we've seen real images dismissed as fake by detection tools, which have then spread on social media and actually led to more disinformation. Watermarking is within the media, on the pixel level or on the wave level in audio. And the way to think about watermarking in my mind is almost like good faith red flags. So this is the intentional injection of signals, of artifacts into a piece of media, which stand out to a detection tool. So if a deepfake detection tool is looking for signals which are unintentional in a piece of media, watermarking is providing those detection tools with big, hello, I'm fake labels, right? What C2PA does is it attaches data to a piece of media. So it's kind of external to the piece of media itself, what you're hearing, what you're seeing, but it's a piece of metadata which is cryptographically secured. So it's like a nutrition label, if you think about it in that sense. So the moment a piece of AI-generated content is created, the moment an authentic photo is captured on, let's say, a DSLR camera, data is cryptographically secured to that media file and then travels with it throughout its lifetime. It's the most promising approach because it's the most secure technologically. It doesn't have the same robustness issues that, let's say, watermarking or detection has. The biggest challenge is scale, getting the attitudes in society to change to the point where people reflexively look for it. When I was producing that documentary with the BBC, The Future Will Be Synthesized was not necessarily saying that parts of reality in the present aren't synthesized. It was more, these are the early stages. If I'm honest, I don't think I was expecting us to have accelerated so quickly into that synthetic future by 2024. How is this changing society, communications, relationships, how we see ourselves? These are really big questions. It makes me wonder about how this is holding up a looking glass to reality pre-AI generated content. We are starting to see AI generated content seep into areas of our lives, particularly around what we traditionally see as human to human communication or human creativity, that I think does fundamentally change the way that we evaluate the value of human creative endeavors, but also the way that we think about interacting with each other in the digital world. I mean, even yesterday, Apple announced the release of their new iPad. One of the features I think they showed off was this feature where it corrects your gaze. This capability essentially synthetically changes your eye to make it look like you're looking directly at the person. Some people would say, well, great, okay, I'm paying attention to that person. I want them to feel like I'm paying attention to them as if I was looking them in the eye. But for others, it's like, this is sinister. This is weird. This is shaping a reality to something that maybe seems more polite, but it's not real. How is that going to shape expectations of what normal, messy human relationships look like? Their default form of communication now, which is Snapchat or TikTok or Instagram, you know, and I think there is a way that AI could make that potentially even more difficult. You know, you're having a bad hair day in 3 years' time. It might be the case that you just turn up with your avatar and that's acceptable. To us, it might seem strange, but for generations that grow up with that, as the norm, as the kind of feature that's being actively pushed to them by AI companies, I don't see any reason why social norms could not shift in exactly the same way that my grandparents, when they were alive, were utterly overwhelmed and bemused by the world that I lived in, right? I think there's real potential to really help people get access to information in a way that they previously weren't able to. And for that to be something that anyone, regardless of where you're from, you know, this could really open up opportunity, which I think is great. At the same time, I worry about people's ability to recall information, potentially the ability of people to function without these kinds of tools. And I guess the analogy I'd use is my handwriting is now atrocious and I actively cannot handwrite for a long time. Whereas I used to be able to, I did exams that were 4 hours long handwritten. We're living in a time where there is increasing instability in the world in many different regions. And so I wonder if an over-reliance on AI in an increasingly unstable world maybe is going to lead to some situations where we are kind of left without a paddle, so to speak. I think saying outsource your critical thinking and your creativity and your ability to think entirely to that tool, equally naive and ill-advised. And that's one thing that I think actually is really valuable about doing humanities and social sciences based degrees in this time, despite the fact that they're being, you know, attacked and defunded in many different universities, is these degrees, if you engage in them in good faith, give you a real sense of the ability to think critically, to kind of think about broader trends and being able to understand what a good argument looks like, to be able to kind of, have that critical approach to knowledge in the world. If I didn't know a piece of music was AI generated, I could think that was absolutely beautiful. And if someone had said to me, this is the new song by this artist, I could be like, wow, that's amazing. I love it. The moment I know that actually it's AI generated, part of the magic goes for me. And it's the same with writing. It's the same with art in general. And I think that's because there is an intangible value, and it's a real value. It's a real experience. It really does shape the phenomenology of how you experience that music, that piece of art, which comes from knowing that it essentially from one consciousness to another. We can't have that epistemic knowledge of other people having minds, having consciousness. You know, it's kind of Cartesian, right? It's like the only thing I know, I can truly know, is that I am, right? We can't fundamentally know that other people exist. But the way that I think we do come to have those somewhat transcendental experiences between people, I had some teachers who really gave me the opportunity to understand that learning and thinking didn't have to fit into necessarily the box that the curriculum or this kind of state education system prescribed. One teacher, Miss Atkins, gave me a lot of room to express myself and took an interest in my kind of musical interest at the time. I used to love like heavy metal, which was, you know, time has changed, but, you know, she would really engage with me on the things that I was passionate about and helped me, I think, channel that passion into different avenues. Mrs. Gillen, my philosophy teacher, was really good at helping, again, open up this world of, you know, content to me, which really changed the way I thought and actually gave me a subject that I was like, oh, wow, okay, this really fits my kind of somewhat rebellious attitude in some areas, you know, gave me the space to be myself, but also engage in content and ideas that I hadn't really had before.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.